When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moore pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. All right, folks, welcome to episode 103. This is my conversation with Peter Rowan, part two. If you have not heard it yet, backtrack one episode and go back and check out the first part of my conversation with Peter Rowan. And this is the continuation from right where we left off. Please enjoy part two of my episode with Peter Rowan.
Yeah, so I mean, I began to hear bluegrass in Harvard Square. I heard Keith and Rooney and the Charles River Valley Boys, and I got to be friends with Joe Val, and then that's where I started learning the bluegrass.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I asked Joe if we could play a little bit. I wanted to learn it by that point. Well, one of the things that got me was the D28 guitar. Mm-hmm. You know, I went from a Telecaster to a little sort of mahogany 00 But when I heard the bluegrass guys hitting that D28, I went, uh-oh.
It's a thing. Yeah.
I got to have one of them things. And it feels as big on me now as it did when I was younger.
Right.
It's interesting because Elvis was playing a D18.
Oh, was he?
You know, okay. And yeah. So, you know, you got early pictures in your head of how you hang a guitar on you, like a big Martin like that. Because Elvis did it, and he got a lot of photos of him playing guitar.
Yeah.
And so it was like an item, man. And the bluegrassers were making it ring, you know, and it was like, wow, it was acoustic. So I left electric music for a while, mm-hmm. you know, and just got into this whole acousticness. And when I heard Bill Monroe, we used to go to a record shop called Wurlitzer's. They sold organs and pianos, and this Wurlitzer's music in Harvard Square, and sold records. And
cool.
They had about 5 record listening booths.
Okay.
So you could take an LP and take it in the listening booth and listen to the whole thing. Nobody ever said, you've heard enough. So I began to listen to all whatever I could find. And when I heard Bill Monroe, I realized that he was playing the blues in a way that connected with what I was learning to play an acoustic guitar and bluegrass, you know?
Yep.
Different role for the guitar. But one of the first songs that I heard was 6 White Horses.
Mm-hmm.
Or they call it 2 White Horses, I think. But it was in Bill Monroe's recording along with In the Pines, and they were using a lot of blues orientation. And, you know, later when I was a bluegrass boy working with Bill, I asked him, where did he first hear the blues? You know, because I knew he had a mentor, Arnold Schultz, who was a black man from Louisiana. He's from New Orleans. According to Ronnie McCurry, who's a great historian of bluegrass, Arnold Schultz would come up and work the summers in the fall in Kentucky, and then once winter got in, he'd go back to New Orleans. And
okay.
he worked with Bill Monroe's Uncle Penn. He played guitar with Uncle Penn. Well, so I thought I was going to hear about Arnold Schultz, but when I asked Bill, I said, "Where did you first really hear the blues?" He said, "Well, when he hired Flatt and Scruggs, they were so green that I had to take them to New Orleans
for them
to learn some, you know, funk, you know."
Right. Oh, that's awesome.
And
wow.
Yeah, he told me that. I mean, it's amazing. And I said, "Really? How long did you stay down?" He said, "I kept them boys, and we worked out of there for 2.5 months.
Wow.
See, Bill, at that time, because the Monroe brothers had been so big, he had made a deal with Charlie that Charlie would get everything east of the Mississippi River for a while. And so Bill went to Texas. He went to Louisiana. He worked the whole western world and picked up a lot of music. And I said, "What kind of music could you hear in New Orleans in those days?" He said, "Well, a man could hear any kind of music." Yeah. And I asked him, what were the styles, you know? Because the thing with Bill was that he would take out his mandolin about 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And he'd play for about 40 minutes. And he'd cover some ground. But it wouldn't be a bunch of fiddle tunes.
Uh-huh.
It'd be kind of like whatever the soul of High Lonesome really is. It would be like very tremolo-y and slow and haunting sounding, you know.
Wow.
And when he was, when I sat down, I'd been driving and the other driver jumped in and was taken over, and I came back and I'd heard Bill playing for almost an hour, and I came back and I sat.
This is now, on the bus.
And most people, you know, at the time were like, you know, "Don't bother Bill," right? You know, because he's the genius. But I was naive enough to just, I mean, he knew. He kind of saw me coming. I was a greenhorn. But I was as enamored of what what was played musically off stage as I was of doing the shows on stage.
Yeah.
Because Bill had a way of passing the time musically, like we all do, right? We all sit around and play a little bit.
Sure, of course. So,
but Bill was never just like got a show to do. Bill was always in music, and that was the thing about him. So when I heard him playing back there in the back of the bus, I finished my shift and somebody climbed in the seat and we'd change on the fly, you know.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. Get to the top of hills, throw that bus in neutral, climb out of that seat. Yeah, the person would climb in.
Wow.
And you know, whisper a prayer and try and double clutch it back into fifth gear. So I went back and Bill was playing this haunting stuff. And the first thing he said, he was playing this kind of like really mystical stuff. And he said, when he finished, he addressed me, which meant that I was recognized as being there. I was part of his moment. I wasn't intruding. He was being friendly. He said, "That there's the Indian sound."
Wow.
And he meant American Indian.
Yep, yep.
He was very much tuned into that, what that was. And he wrote Cheyenne, you know, where there's a whole Indian cry in there. In fact, my whole thing about Land of the Navajo was based on the fact that Bill had chanted Indian sounding chanting in one of his songs.
Okay.
His thing, it was, hey, and the fiddles take over and play. It's a break, you know, it's a fast tune, but he chants in it like that.
Right.
And so, I mean, I felt like, well, Land of the Navajo is just an extension of those, of that kind of an idea.
Yeah.
So he said, that's the Indian sound. I said, wow. He's playing a little more and this was a dialogue, you know, and I said, where did you first hear the blues? And he told me about New Orleans. And he said, when I asked him, I said, what kind of, like what kind of blues or whatever? Mm-hmm. He said, you had the stomp time, you had the jump time, mm-hmm. you had the waltz, and of course you had the slow drag.
Oh, yeah.
I had never heard of the slow drag before.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, that is a big part of what is called the lowdown blues.
Had he like worked on that kind of music at all, or he had just sort of absorbed it?
A friend of mine, Greg Gehring, and I have sat around and parsed this a little bit. Greg can play piano. And one day we were messing around. I said, we were doing Rocky Road Blues or something, Bill's tune. I said, hey, Greg played mandolin with Jimmy Martin a little bit before he, you know, got into his country music thing. I said, play Bill's mandolin solo. And we just almost fell over just because Bill's right is playing the right hand of a boogie woogie or barrel house piano.
Yeah.
When he plays the blues.
Interesting.
I mean, because it's in a cut in a, kind of a, I wouldn't say a hoedown beat, but it's kind of in a 2-4 polka-ish bluegrassy time. I mean, Bill, he thought a lot about it. He really did. He once said to me, he said, you know, Pete, I've had to keep as much out of bluegrass as I put into it.
Wow, that's a heavy quote, man.
Yeah. Anyway, so It's pretty vast, but the right hand on the piano is what Bill was picking up on the playing the blues.
That totally makes sense, actually. I get that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We didn't really get into like how you got that gig in the first place, but what was your overall experience playing for him?
Well, the thing is, okay, Bill Keith and Jim Rooney had a little band, and Joe Val, who had played mandolin with them, had gone over to play with Bob Siggins and John Cook and the Charles River Valley Boys. And these were Harvard Square
right.
bluegrass bands. And then you had the Lilly Brothers and Don Stover across the river in Boston at the Hillbilly Ranch. And so and the one guy who moved between both scenes was Joe Val. And Joe had been with Keith and Rooney, and then now he was working with the River Valley Boys. And so Joe and I had been playing together, and I had been picking up some mandolin from me playing with Joe Val. I played guitar, he played mandolin, but I was always learning mandolin on the side. I loved the mandolin. Mm-hmm. So Bill Keith hired me to play with him and Jim. So I became the tenor singer in Keith and Rooney's band.
Okay, cool.
And yeah, and now Bill Keith had been a bluegrass boy with Bill Monroe. And Bill Monroe was coming up to play a show up in Boston. He was going to play Doc Watson's birthday. And it was, they needed to get, he was coming alone. So Bill Keith put the band together.
Okay.
He got Everett Lilly's son, Everett Jr., to play bass. He got Tex Logan to play fiddle. And a young player, Gene Loewinger, came up with Tex from New Jersey. Of course, Bill Keith played banjo, and he hired me as a guitar player. And I was just totally thrilled. And they came up, and we did a couple of shows up in the country, up in Vermont and stuff like that. Played a little fiddler's convention or something like that. This was in the fall.
How did it go? Like, when you walked up on stage with him for the first time, was it pretty smooth sailing? Or
We had all listened to his music on records.
Yeah.
And he was... His basic vibe was step up.
Okay, yeah. Don't be shy.
You know, I mean, he was a good leader.
Yeah.
You know, he was a good leader.
And was he good to you guys, like, as relative youngsters that he didn't know? Was he congenial and helpful and stuff? Or
Well, what? I just remember one of the first nights we were going through some songs, and he stood about 15 feet away listening to us stand as a little cluster.
Yeah.
He never said anything. He just directed by his rhythm on the mandolin.
Okay.
I mean, he just defined everything.
Yep.
His time was very, very steady. Although I still listen to some of those recordings, and I swear they cheat a little bit, those when they play the instrumentals so fast.
What do you mean?
They sound like they jump ahead.
Oh, I mean,
it's called that. Everybody talks about it. It's called the bluegrass time thing.
Uh-huh.
And there is something absolutely amazing about it, the way the old timers played. But it's not that they sped up. It's just that they jumped ahead in the time of the song somehow. I still can't explain it.
Like a feel thing more than anything else? Or do you mean like they're actually like jumping?
If they're playing a phrase like, you know, a phrase played square would be like, da 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 da. Right? And they would play it.
Okay.
Just into the next phrase if they did. And nobody ever explained it. But it was very hard to keep up with some of those. Well, the thing is, oh, here you go. When the band played, you could feel the banjo, keep really good time on the guitar during the banjo, during the fiddle, yeah. during this. But during Bill's solo, he expected the time to be so strong that if he started to do these syncopations, that it wouldn't throw you off.
Okay.
But it was like holding on to a wild horse. It was,
right.
It's like very difficult to keep time.
Yeah.
When this guy's doing all this, like, talk about playing on the front edge of the beat, but uh-huh. in time, which was weird, you know, because it sounds like you're speeding up and you sound like you're falling behind, but you're not.
Uh-huh.
And just one of the little bluegrass tricks that you had to learn. Yeah, it was Bill Keith that put it together. And, mm-hmm. and Bill Monroe said, you ought to come to Nashville, Pete. I can help you.
Really?
Yeah. Now, he may have thought I was going to should be a country music artist. I don't know. But I went there assuming he meant joining his band.
Okay. Did he have a band back in Nashville at that time, or was he sort of bandless?
Well, he had some local folks that he played with.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, a pretty steady fiddler. Bill wasn't touring a lot.
Right.
He was in his early 50s at that point, and rock and roll had pretty much blown the wind out of the sails. of bluegrass. Bluegrass was a chart music in the early 50s. Blue Moon of Kentucky was, by Bill Monroe, a chart record. And then Elvis, of course, put it through the roof. But the Stanley Brothers, they were on the charts.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever nobody considered bluegrass an esoteric music. It was just another part of the variety of country music before everything got super defined.
So you moved to Nashville and kind of joined his band. And as you said, he wasn't touring a lot, but you guys did some sessions and I know that you're on a...
Well, then things change, you see.
Okay.
I mean, he wasn't touring a lot, but at that time, Mike Seeger and Ralph Rinsler, Ralph was managing Bill and Doc Watson. And he was also in charge of the Smithsonian Folklife thing, which was the Smithsonian Institute's outreach into the folk traditions of America, which Ralph was championing. And he was also big into the Balfour Brothers and folks in Louisiana. And Ralph, he was very mobile. He'd be in Nashville. We'd drive up to North Carolina, go visit folks who lived up in the country with one cow and a little little shed over a stream where they kept their butter and cream. And really, the whole thing of the discovering the roots of what America was through the music and through the people in the mountains of the South, at least for that part of it. And they did an article that came out in Sing Out magazine called Bill Monroe, the Daddy of Bluegrass Music. Because Flatt and Scruggs were getting all the kind of, recognition because they were on television.
Yeah.
On the Andy Griffith Show. And also did the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies. Not the Andy Griffith Show, but the Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah. The Dillards were the band, and the Kentucky Colonels did a little bit with Andy Griffith on the Andy Griffith Mayberry Show. But because Flatt and Scruggs were identified as what bluegrass was, Ralph, who knew Bill and was managing him, wanted to have the recognition that Bill was the originator.
Okay.
That it was his band in the beginning that started the whole deal. So they wrote this article in Sing Out magazine, which it described the whole thing, where Bill came from, his whole history. So yep. The college kids now were exposed to him. So when he came up to Boston, it was to play for the folk music enthusiasts in the Boston area. Ralph felt that people could really hear Bill's thing if they given half a chance. If Bill,
like, almost reintroducing him.
Reintroducing him to a younger crowd.
Yeah.
When I came to Nashville and joined the band, then I also brought in another player, Lamar Greer, from the D.C. area that I had met from Washington, D.C. area,
yeah,
where Mike Seeger and Smiley Hobbs and many, many country gentlemen and many, many bluegrass bands were in that scene. That was like a whole scene, the Baltimore, Washington area. And Lamar had that wonderful feel in his banjo playing. So when Don Leinberger quit, when I joined the band, it was very slow when I joined the band. You know, the Grand Ole Opry was everything. You know, he played every weekend that he wasn't away, and he wasn't away at all. So I think what started to happen was an energy began to build. Mm-hmm. Once I got him in the band, but then we traveled, and there was a young fiddle player on the West Coast who was studying under Scotty Stoneman, who was quite a vibrant player.
Yeah.
And Richard Green. And he was, at the time, began to play in the Bluegrass Boys, which was Ralph Rinsler's old band with John Harold, Bob Yellen. And as Bill began to get busy, you know, he was 55 years old.
This is like 66 kind of era?
65.
Okay.
See, I was down there in and out of the area from the 63 playing on the Opry and then going away and coming back. It was like a transition. Mm-hmm. And so by 64, I was living in Nashville, and that's my debut as a member of the band was in October of 64. And so by the spring of 65, we had the young Gene Loewinger playing fiddle, and we toured, we went to England. It was like, I guess Ralph did everything he could as he was becoming more full-time Doc Watson's manager. But he did everything he could to promote Bill as, you know, a progenitor and a keeper of tradition. Yeah. You know, like when they say bluegrass is deep, it is deep. I mean, but not everybody knows how or can go to how deep it really is. But it sort of doesn't matter because it's such a great style mm-hmm. that, like, you know, you just hear all kinds of people playing bluegrass. I guess sincerity is part of it, you know, and sincerity and a kind of a, I wouldn't know how to say it. It's a kind of a, of all the different styles of bluegrass, I think the most appealing still is this sort of enthusiastic sincerity, where people who actually learn their instrument, they haven't gotten to be too smug about it, you know? Right. But they go like.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, here's a song, and I think it's in the key of what key is this one in? You know, you ask a bandmate, you know, they go, "Oh, it's D." Oh, yeah, D. This is the one in D. You know, it's like this is very endearing. You know,
yeah.
So once that band has solidified, though, with Richard Green on fiddle and Lamar on banjo and Jimmy Monroe on bass, I guess the more the powers that be went, Bill has got a crack band now. You know, it's not just like. Just the in-town folks just kind of playing his music. I mean, he was always an
young whippersnappers.
A bunch of whippersnappers. And he was always an Opry star. I mean, you know, but, you know, when my first show with Bill Monroe, the next week came back and we weren't traveling that much that fall. We didn't travel much until March of the next year. Mm-hmm. Union scale was $17.50 for Friday night at the Opry.
Hasn't changed much.
Yeah. And then Saturday night when you did two shows, you got $24.50.
Wow.
Yeah. Dang bargain. But once that band was in place, there was an excitement generated. You know, it was an excitement. But you know, you go through a lot when you're a touring band, as you know, you go through lifetimes of relationships and all kinds of things that.
And so things really did pick up for him in that era when you guys joined and you started touring a fair amount.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, we were working and we worked colleges. He had never mm-hmm. played in hardly any colleges, but Ralph's belief, you know, and Ralph was not alone. I mean, Mike Seeger and all these other folks that really knew the scope of folk music knew that Bill had a lot to give, but you know, he was quite angry for a while.
Was he?
It was tough, yeah. He was very, he told me once, he said, you don't know how hard it is coming up. You know, you boys today.
You got it easy. What kind of a guy was he like to work for? Was he pretty demanding of you guys, or was he at an age where he was just kind of.
Well, he was a man of few words, really.
Okay.
You know, he never really described what he wanted, but if you weren't doing it, you knew it.
You'd hear about it. Yeah. Do you have?
Well, you would. No, he wouldn't say anything. He'd just vibe you.
Really?
Yeah. You'd be very uncomfortable going, well, I must be doing something wrong.
And he'd leave it up to you to figure it out.
You know, you'd be standing in a circle of a jam session. And all of a sudden, he'd be standing in front of you and you'd be playing to his back and be like, okay.
Yeah. Do you have recollections of the studio sessions you did with him?
there was an A&R guy in there from Decca Records, Harry Silverstein. And I guess he and Bill had worked out the songs they were going to do beforehand. So that we never really got to rehearse. Those are just learning the songs and playing them in the studio. Uh-huh. I have to say, too, that Bill knew how to keep it fresh. You know, he didn't want it overly rehearsed.
Okay, yeah.
Although I know in later years, producers got him to, you know,
tighten things up a bit.
Tighten things up, organize more and more.
Yeah.
Well, I can't tell whether it was from not wanting to, you know, he was a mysterious guy. You know, if we did rehearse, he would just say, "You boys play a few numbers," and he'd sit there and listen and look at his royalty statements that came in the mail in that building. We'd rehearse it at the old Opry building in the room where Hank Williams first made his demos, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, the old what they call that, the Opry. It was sort of the office side of the WSM organization at the time.
Part of the Ryman or not attached?
No, it's a separate building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we rehearsed upstairs in this little room that was sort of a studio. But Bill would just listen to us play, but he got his mail in that building. And he would just, you know, if it was a royalty statement, he would put the check in his hat. and other things just went in the wastebasket, unopened.
But just the checks, please.
Just the checks. Thank you very much. And then when we finished rehearsing, you know, we'd play for an hour or so, and he'd take out his mandolin, finally. And every time he would play the Schottische. He would play this thing, this German interpretation of a Scottish Strathspey called a Schottische.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Well, the rhythm is... It survived in Western swing down in Texas, even to this day. Schottisches are played at the dances. It's how to describe it, but I think in it were some secrets of what Bill would call the timing. One is that triplet that you have to play a triplet when you start a phrase. You da 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 da, you know, mm-hmm. instead of da 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 da, you know, you have to play the. You know, that little triplet, which, if you go through all the bluegrass of the years of development of his style, he used to play a lot of triplets when Flat and Scruggs were in the band. I think the time that it was pre Elvis Blue Moon of Kentucky, where Bill's sense of mandolin playing was much more melodic.
Okay.
During the tune, he would just play these. He'd play with the things that's possible on a mandolin, like triplets, because you got the double strings. You can go over them and kind of get all these wonderful timing things. And then once when Elvis did Blue Moon of Kentucky, Bill kind of went to this hard backbeat. You know, this real, you know, chop, they called it, his backbeat chop, because Elvis had. That happened after Elvis did Blue Moon of Kentucky. So Bill added that backbeat chop became predominant.
I'll say.
You know, and then the fiddles became the more present.
Yeah, he's almost like the drummer.
Yeah. But, you know, if you listen to one tune called Sweetheart, You Done Me Wrong, mm-hmm. with Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and Chubby Wise, it is so mellifluous. It is unbelievable. They're all playing kind of very freely, because the time I think was better. The time was more. Nobody was defining it. You know, the guitar was doing its thing, the bass was doing its thing, the banjo was. I mean, Earl Scruggs' timing. I mean, I respect all banjo players that really go for it, but. I mean, I think Earl's timing was something special, very, very special. You know, and he had a way of doing his role that was unusual. And I think it freed Bill up. I think it freed him up. Even though a song like Will You Be Loving Another Man, which is a fast song, Bill doesn't chop, but he's playing all through the song. you can hear him just wailing away, you know, just doing his thing, which later on it was chopping and then solo. He'd still play a little backup, but he kind of relegated the backup then to the fiddles later on. And and I think too the chemistry with Flat and Scruggs and Chubby Wise, that was very, very different and very special. You know what I mean? It's like the Beatles were the Beatles.
Yeah.
Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys were Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. I mean, and I love all of the incarnations of the Bluegrass Boys and Bill, but you know,
I sort of think of it in a similar light as to like Buck Owens or something. You know, when that main Buckaroo band was ticking on all cylinders. That's sort
of when it all comes together, right? Yeah. Olden in the Way. Another one.
Do you mind talking a little bit about that project? Like, obviously you. You have a long history with Grisman and Jerry Garcia and Vassar Clemens was in that. And I'm just curious how that project came together. And if you.
I was in this rock and roll band called Sea Train, and Richard Green, the fiddler from Bill Monroe's band, was in the band with me. And we had gone from the West Coast living back East. And I just got really tired of the grind and the sense of we were always trying to pay off this debt to the management. Mm-hmm. And also my two brothers had moved out west to, Northern California, basically with David Grisman as their producer. And David and I had been playing together for a long time before I joined C-Train. We had had a band called Earth Opera.
Right.
For Elektra Records. It was another career buster. You know, I'm famous for like just getting it right there and then going, shit, man. When you decide to leave a band, suddenly you realize you could be there forever.
Yeah.
I'd come back out west to hang out with my brothers a little bit. And I wanted to get away from New England too. It was very crowded and very hard to deal with the weather in the wintertime touring and everything, it was good to have a band like Sea Train. It was a really rocking band and we played a lot of dates with the band and that was fun. Anyway, I came back out west and hanging out with David Grisman and was producing my brothers for Columbia Records.
Yeah.
And every morning we're just picking a little bit, you know. Stinson Beach was very laid back and we were like barefoot a lot.
Is that Bay Area? Is that where you were?
Yeah, just north of San Francisco on the coast.
Yeah.
And one day he said, Garcia lives up the hill here. He likes to play. I was like, oh yeah, we went up and saw Jerry greeted us with the banjo strapped on in the yard. Oh yeah. And we just started, Garcia was just a bubbling, joyous person.
Were you aware of him? Like some of the psychedelic bands of the Bay Area at the time?
Well, I was aware of Jerry.
Yeah.
Because he had learned a lot of the same tunes that I had done. We both done a song called Cold Rain and Snow.
Oh, okay.
The early Grateful Dead version. And then I had done a version with a band called Mule Skinner that David Grisman and myself and Clarence White.
Clarence White.
And Richard Green, Bill Keith. So we just started picking up at Jerry's house. And it was all good energy, all very positive, all sort of building. And the singing was fun. You know, we had a nice trio of voices that were very different. Each voice was different. So it made a nice combination. And we had some dates coming up and it was like, who are we going to get to play fiddle? John Hartford had played a little bit with us. Richard Green had played a little with us, but they were all tied up with other things. So I still had the number from the days when I used to go down and play in Monroe, Louisiana, and then have breakfast at Rule Yarbrough's house up in Alabama on the way home and listen to tapes of their New Year's party with Vassar Clemens. Of course, we knew who Vassar was, but Vassar had, pretty much run the course of being a bluegrass guy and then played with the Judy Lynn Show and become a, then he'd quit, quit
Oh,
the
really?
Road.
Okay.
Yeah. and was working in a family business back in Florida, but he was still playing. And I had heard these tapes when we were traveling. And so I called up Ruhl. I still had his number, and he gave me Vassar's number.
Yeah.
It was only 5 years since I'd been a bluegrass boy.
Okay.
In all that time, we'd done three, oh, how many projects? We'd done two Earth Opera, Mule Skinner. And two Sea Train. In 5 or 6 records in 5 years.
Man.
And it made time seem like we'd done a lot. A lot of time had gone by, but it was a small amount of time. It's funny how time appears, right? You know,
I know.
What appears long. And so it wasn't that long. And Vassar was on board right from the start. He said,
"Really?
Yeah." He said, "Oh, I'd love to play with you." He knew who I was. And I that's when I began to realize that by being with Bill, I'd become known, even though I was not a...
You had a reputation.
Well, you know, I mean, players know who the players are.
Of course,
you know, it's just like, it's not always about publicity and, you know, commerciality. The players are always, especially in bluegrass, it's all about the players. It's like I said, you know, it's the people I met that got me interested, because they were interested in me and interested in the music. Yeah. And so Vassar joined us, and then he would just come out to the West Coast, and we'd do two or three, a long week or something like that. You know, Jerry was into it. And the Dead were sort of taking a slight break.
Okay. So he had time.
They weren't touring heavily. So there was room for Jerry's side project.
Yeah.
But then they decided to tour. And that's when we did our Olden and the Ways 1 tour, piggybacking on a Grateful Dead tour.
Oh my God.
And
really?
It was not, yeah, it was, well, we only did about 4 dates around the Philadelphia, New York area.
Yeah.
And Ramblin' Jack Elliott was on that tour. So it was nice to see Jack.
Wow. That's quite the show.
But you could see that it was hard on Jerry, even though he was, you know, willing to try and do too much. I mean, he really did.
But he was just being treated differently, or what was the...
Well, no, it's just that the bluegrass shows, he was starting to get really a lot of exposure, and, you know, people coming up to him and everything like that. And in the Grateful Dead context, the audience was kept away, you know, they were bigger shows, really bigger shows. In the bluegrass world, nobody really bothered him, but when fans knew that Jerry was around, they would just, you know, they'd sort of flock.
Yeah.
Mostly young guys.
Really?
You know, yeah. And they'd have girls with them, but it was mostly guys who saw Jerry as a kind of a brighter reflection of themselves. You know? Yeah. And that was pressure for him. And a lot of bluegrass dates were outdoors, and Jerry had allergies.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, so you get that outdoor ambience, and then he was uncomfortable, you know.
Right.
And I think the situation wasn't as controlled as with the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And so they were, compared to Olden in a way, were just highly organized. And yet, you know, Jerry would still have his own, you know, his own crew with him.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have Steve Parrish would still be on the Olden and the Way gigs watching out for Jerry.
He was like his handler or something?
No, he's just road manager.
Okay, yeah.
You know, but then, you know, again, Jerry was, his star was rising. And so he became very busy. The Grateful Dead came back together strong, and they were like determined to not, you know, I guess they, as a band, they had meant, maybe they had been together 10 years and they had accomplished something, but they came back with heavier management and more organization. And it just became more difficult. What was Olden in the Way going to be, you know,
right.
A little side project or this or that. And then David decided he was going to get into making his music, his own solo music. And yeah, we all decided, I think, to follow our own course.
So when you made that record, was it just like a quick session in a studio somewhere, or how did you
We did two separate 7-night stands at the boarding house in San Francisco. Okay.
So that whole thing is live? There's no studio element to it?
They've never released the few tunes we did in the studio.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought some of it was studio, but it's all live. That's cool.
Grisman got a hold of the rights to put the records out because he has a record company. And so I don't know if he has or hasn't put out any of the studio stuff, but we tried in the studio, but it
didn't have the thing.
It didn't have the spark of the live night after night. And Jerry was very much of a live performer, you know, they fed off the crowd, you know, and as you can hear on that record, the crowd was just like, they didn't know what they were getting hit with, but it was bluegrass.
What was Owsley's role in that whole, scene?
Oh, Bear. Well, we lived in the same town, very close by to each other. And, you know, he was an engaging character, and he was self-appointed sound man for Old In The Way. And one night we were over in Berkeley, and we got there late, and we were doing a sound check on stage. And the board was facing us in a balcony.
Yeah.
You know, like where lights usually are. And you could see Owsley in there with the green lights from the mixing board shining in his face and cables, you know, in his teeth and over his shoulders.
Yeah.
And his eyes kind of glowing. And Garcia walks up to me and he goes, "Dig Owsley, man. He really loves his job." But like all good things, you know, I mean, it could have been an epic sort of kept going through the years. But when David left, Jerry said, you know, that he'd like to keep going. And
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I guess I was just a little too tied up in who we were to think that we could hire somebody else. But it was funny. John Starling had called me and said, if Grisman ever quits, you know, there's this young kid, Ricky Skaggs, who could really do the job.
Really?
Can you imagine?
Wow. Ricky and Jerry in a band together. That's a trippy thought.
A sort of regret, even remorse that did we do everything we could, but I guess we did, you know, and all those recordings are consecutive nights. And when the first record came out, the Old and In The Way record, everybody, or at least David, thought that was the only good stuff. The rest of it was not worth putting out.
Just the first night?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. So then, of course, now there's 12 records of, you know, at least 12 records of those live shows. And they're all good. The thing about Old and In The Way was that, I mean, if you try and hold it to standards of like strict tempo and a kind of like a
modern sensibility.
Well, something about it that's the charm of Old and In The Way is what it is. It's just what is what it is.
It's soulful, man. Yeah.
It's soulful. It's a bunch of guys really trying.
Yeah.
and they're too stoned to know if they're doing any good.
Well, listen, man, we're sort of hitting these weird technical glitches and I've taken up a ton of your time. I really appreciate hearing all these stories, and I'll have to try and reconnect with you at some point to talk about some of the other projects you've been doing. And next time you put out a record, we'll talk again and talk about that. But I really appreciate hearing all this stuff, man.
Great, man. I'll look forward to it.
All right.
Anytime.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Peter.
See you, Steve. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
All right. That concludes both parts of my conversation with Peter Rowan. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research.
And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.